their secret mountain lair somewhere in Colorado. This is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast with your hosts, Jason Odell and Rick Walker.
Hey everyone, I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And this is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us today. How are you doing, Rick?
I'm doing fine.
Good. What kind of fun things have been going on? Been doing any photography or just kind of hanging tight?
I always do some photography.
Yeah. Playing around with stuff.
Sometimes it's stuff that's just therapeutic and doesn't turn out great, but that's all right.
I was playing
but
around.
But I am looking forward to, I'm going to go to the Tetons in Yellowstone.
Oh, nice.
At the end of September.
Right. Yeah, awesome.
Looking forward to that.
Well, I'll be in South Dakota next week with my workshop group. Small group, but that's okay. We're going to keep things socially distanced. But I go to the Badlands National Park every year. And hopefully next year I can take a full-size group because it is such one of my favorite places to photograph.
Oh, it's an awesome place.
Yeah, it's really good. It's a great place to be away from everyone because it really can feel like you're just out there in the open spaces with cool rock formations around you. It's pretty awesome.
Well, there's so much good subject matter. Just a wonderful spot.
I picked up the 50mm 1.8 for my Nikon Z. Mm-hmm. I just decided to get one prime. So that was it, partly because it's so good with the infrared camera, like amazingly good. We did that review of all of our lenses with infrared, which we posted out a couple of weeks ago. So we're kind of adding to
on
the
your
database.
Website.
Yeah. And there's a link to it from our page. But man, that one is amazing. It's perfect for infrared. It has no flaws whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, one thing we've talked about a little bit, but the current generation of lenses that's out there, and it's not just Nikon, boy, are they good.
They really are.
And you know, you don't want to get too worked up over that because it's not like buying one will suddenly make all your pictures good. But it is remarkable how high of quality lenses are these days. Just amazing.
When you can, you know, I think the difference between lenses that are coming out now, especially these Z mount lenses, at least what I've seen, is that the old rule of thumb was that you would buy an F, you know, a fast lens like a 1.4 to generally shoot it, you know, stop down a little bit. So you're getting mm-hmm. maximum sharpness at like F2 or something like that. Right. Mm-hmm. And you could shoot them wide open, but they would be more prone to a little bit of corner softness and aberrations. But my goodness, these things, you can shoot them pretty much wide open and they almost don't fall off any sharpness in the corners. It's crazy how good they are, especially these primes.
Yeah. And again, it's not just Nikons. All the manufacturers are coming out with new lenses that are just incredible. The only thing is that They're a little bit on the large size.
Yeah.
In general, you know, it varies a little bit, but they're a little bit big, but not horrible. Certainly that one that you got is very pleasant to use. It's just not as tiny as
the 50mm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, for a 50mm lens, it's kind of large, but it's not like it's a problem to use it. It's still really nice. It's not awkward to hold.
No, it's very pleasant.
And in fact, I like the design with some of these lenses where the barrels are pretty much uniform diameter. So you don't have a lot of weird ways to hold them. You can just kind of hold it in your hand at whatever feels most comfortable.
Yeah.
But 50s is not on our list for today. Our episode today, we're going to actually talk about using longer focal lengths, specifically telephoto lenses today. And then we'll talk about another kind of stuff in our next episode, hopefully, right?
Yep. Kind of the opposite end.
Kind of go the other way.
But for today, what we're thinking about are lenses that are 300mm plus. Whether they're a zoom that encompasses that focal length and above, or, you know, just hits it, or fixed focal length lenses, all of them.
Yeah, it's good. So telephoto traditionally could be defined as, well, once upon a time, it was anything over 50 millimeters really was considered, yeah. You know, I mean, 85, even 70, but 85, 105, 135, those are all telephoto lenses. They all have their uses, but we're talking about the longer ones today. So we're going to go with 300 millimeters and up. And let's start off before we get into any of the technical stuff. I mean, there's a variety of ways to get there. There's tons of lenses that can get you in that 300 millimeter territory. And like you said, they're not always big, heavy, expensive things. Some of them are quite affordable. Zooms, like 70 to 300 zoom, for example, mm-hmm. very affordable mm-hmm. lens, and the newest one's pretty good. Let's talk about, I think when most people think 300 millimeters and up, when we're talking about subjects, I think most people think, oh, this is what you use for sports. This is what you use for wildlife and birds, and mm-hmm. birds are wildlife, I guess. but there's more to it than that. I mean, that's all true. And, you know, 300 millimeters is kind of the ideal lens for sports, especially if you can be right up on a sideline. It gives you enough reach, but you're not cutting body parts off. You know, then you've got the guy who's sitting in the end zone at the American football game with the 600 millimeter F4, right? And you mm-hmm. can even get lenses that are longer than that. I mean, Nikon makes an 800 millimeter now. I mean, there's you know, long lenses, and, you know, by doing things like adding teleconverters, you can get a lot of reach. But there are subjects where you just don't even think about it, where these longer lenses might be sitting at home or in your bag, and you could be using them to get some different, more unique compositions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about some of that, because I mean, I think there's some good subjects out there that people might be forgetting about. And I think there's two instances where you would want to use a telephoto lens, and one would be subject isolation. Mm-hmm. Where you really want to blur a background and isolate a subject. And two would be where you want to compress distant elements together in the frame, you know, layers. So with that in mind, let's talk about some fun subjects for telephotos.
Yeah, and I'll just throw out one other variation too. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and it really has to do more so with the background, but with those longer focal lengths, you can blur out a background nicely. And if you have the right background behind the subject, you could have, let's say, a meadow full of flowers, and just, you know, you could have a wash of color, you mm-hmm. know, with your subject. So it can be a really interesting look. You've got subject isolation, but you also have this interesting thing going on with the background in terms of colors and smoothness and, you know, all of those kinds of things.
Absolutely.
But we'll talk more about that in a second. But, so, you know, just some things I've shot with that kind of focal length or more that's outside the norm. Certainly, I've done landscape shots at 300 mm-hmm. millimeters or 400 millimeters and gotten ones that I liked a lot, especially when the weather was interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was having to shoot through some mist or some clouds or whatever. I've done flower photography, you know, many times with longer right. focal lengths. Especially 300 millimeter lenses.
We did that last summer, actually.
That's true. Yeah.
Up in
Crested. It's not the first time. I can remember shooting wildflowers with my 200 to 400 millimeter lens, you know, a long time ago in Maine when I couldn't go out on the boat to photograph the puffins. And I actually had a great time doing that.
Sometimes, isn't that interesting, where you get stuck? You think you're going for one subject, and then you have this lens, and so you just bring it out and use it for something else, and you make do, and then you can be pleasantly surprised with the results.
Yeah, and people in the environment, where you're really wanting to emphasize the people and blur out the background a little bit, that can be nice too. So there are lots of things.
Yeah, and I've certainly used it, and, you know, I talk about when I go with landscapes, we generally talk about sort of the three lens kit, you know, your super wide, your mid-range zoom, and then your 70 to 200 telephoto, if you think about the traditional kit. But when I go to South Dakota next week for the Badlands, I'm going to be making sure that there's a long lens in my bag, at least 300, or a way to get to 300. That might be putting a teleconverter on the 70 to 200 zoom. Or I might even bring my 500 because I'm driving there. I can carry this stuff. But there are a lot of scenes in Badlands National Park and other places where you can get the layers and all of the elements compressed together, and you can find little isolated subjects, you know, maybe a little flower on a rock somewhere kind of at a distance, and you can get in tight on that subject. And it makes a difference in the kinds of shots you can get. One of my clients, this was several years ago, one of my clients and one of our good listeners was out with me in the Badlands, and we had the most amazing low fog in one of the basins where you're overlooking the area, and the tops of the rock formations were just peeking through. I didn't have quite what he, and I think he had brought the 80 to 400, I think was his telephoto zoom that he brought on the workshop that year. And his shots being able to get that were just nice, because it was just a tight composition of these little rocks poking through the, surrounded by fog. It was really, really wonderful. And so it's always a nice idea to have a telephoto when you're on a on a landscape kind of trip, just because you never know what compositions you might find. And those are things that set your photos apart from everybody else going to that location, right? So
yeah, it's useful. And in a place like the Badlands, and it's true other places as well, you put a lens like that in your camera, and you were talking about picking out little details in the landscape. You can have a blast with that. And once you start looking for things like that, you'll find others. And they're all quite different than the normal shots that people get there. So just like you were saying, it's a way to differentiate your photos from what the vast majority of people might take.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
It's fun.
So let's move into then the technical stuff, because there's some technique and there's some best practices for using telephoto lenses, because first of all, most of them start to get into the big and heavy department quite quickly. This is especially true for the fixed focal length prime lenses, you know, the 300. And there's some smaller ones that are certainly hand holdable, but when you start talking about the bigger ones, the 300 2.8s or the 400 2.8 or the 500 f/4, those, you know, you don't walk around most of the time hand holding those lenses. Even a lens like the 200 to 500 Nikon, which is a great lens, or the Sigma and Tamron, they have the 120 to 600s. Those are hand holdable, but they're still several pounds. They get kind of heavy after a while.
Yeah. And there's a difference between being able to handhold them for a few minutes and doing a long shooting session with them where
exactly
it'll just kind of wear you out after a while, and you're going to eventually feel like stopping shooting, you know, which is always a bad thing. So that's when things like a monopod or a tripod can be pretty handy.
Yeah.
I think if you can get away with no more than a monopod, that's nice.
With today's
a lot more agility.
Yeah. Today's lenses make that possible. Using a monopod is not always the easiest thing to do. It takes a lot of practice, actually. They tend to twist. You know, you're stabilized, but I like using a little one directional tilt head on the top of a monopod, so I can change the angle a little bit when I'm shooting.
Ditto.
But one thing
you can use a ball head.
Yeah,
I find it really awkward.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of putting a ball head on a monopod. I know people who've done that. It can work, but it's a little bit too floppy.
Yeah. And you can also go without a head and just mount the lens directly onto the monopod, and that will work okay as long as the angles that you're shooting at aren't too far down and too far up. You know, if you're trying to get a shot of a bird up in a tree that's not too far away, that it can be really awkward without a tilt head.
Yeah, and that's usually what you see the sports photographers doing. They're on a sideline somewhere, they're kneeling, they're at one angle, so everything is in the same general level, and they can get away with that because they're not going up or down much, they're just going left and right, and the monopods are perfect for that. Let's talk about shutter speed for a second too, because you know, a lot of times, I mean, we talk about shutter speed for action photography, but shutter speed is important for just getting sharp shots, you know, even on a stationary subject. And with the smaller, lighter telephoto lenses, it's very easy to forget sometimes that you have this extra magnification, and you are walking around and hand holding it. You know that, and it's great to have a lens that you can walk around with and hand hold. You know, light lenses like the 70-300. But you've got to remember that if you don't use either a form of image stabilization or a fast shutter speed to match that hand, that focal length, you run the risk of getting blurry photos. And that really becomes a factor if you're using a lens on a camera with a cropped sensor. So that 300 millimeters is now giving you, for example, the equivalent of a 450 millimeter lens. Or, you know, even a 600 millimeter lens, if you think about some of the Micro Four Thirds cameras. So stabilization and shutter speed become really important. Just because you can hand hold the lens doesn't mean you're holding it steady enough for those focal lengths. So it's important. And we've always used that 1/focal length shutter speed rule, which when you have that combined with, some form of, stabilization generally works, but you need to practice. So if you have a little point and shoot camera with one of those like ridiculous zooms on it, it's real easy to get blurry shots because you're shooting at the equivalent of maybe 800 millimeters or something like that.
Right.
But if your shutter speed's 1/100 of a second, you're just not going to get a sharp shot even with image stabilization turned on.
Well, and we'd be straying really into more of a wildlife topic, which we're not doing today, but even though you might be able to hold the lens in a stable manner using image stabilization, that doesn't mean your subject is going along with the plan. You know, if you're doing wildlife, birds and mammals are all a bit twitchy at times.
Right.
And it's amazing how subject blur can really enter into things. So you really kind of have to keep the shutter speed up a bit, you know, when you're doing those kinds of subjects, no matter what you have the lens mounted on.
And frankly, I mean, with today's cameras, it's pretty easy to squeeze out 1/1000 of a second or higher in most conditions with just by raising your ISO. So that's a thing. Now, I mean, so if you're going to hand... So a lot of these lenses will have some form of image stabilization, or it might be built into your camera, right? Some of the mirrorless cameras uses an in-body stabilization or a combination of both, just depending on the make of your camera and your lens. We both like using, we pretty much turn the image stabilization system on just about any time we're using a telephoto lens, wouldn't you say?
That's true for me. Now, I know that theoretically there's supposed to be some issues at higher shutter speeds. I haven't been OCD enough to do a real test.
Okay.
But I'll just say I rarely turn it off and my images seem to be fine. It may be a thing that has improved with more recent technology, which I could believe. But I'll tell you one reason I like having stabilization on is it makes it a lot easier to compose the image, you know, along your focal lengths. You don't have the viewfinder image just going all over the place and maybe a tree is in the shot and then out of the shot and in the shot. And you know what I mean?
Right.
It helps
the jumpiness,
composition, right?
Yeah, it just removes the viewfinder shake, and I really like that as well. The one time I guess where I don't put stabilization on is if I'm on a tripod and I'm absolutely locked down on something,
right?
You know, and maybe using a remote release or something, you know, because it's a true still composition. You know, and I've done this like with shots of like the moon at night, you know, like where you just have everything on a tripod and you're using a fairly slower shutter speed. So stabilization can get messed up when you're on a tripod. So the general rule of thumb is if you're on a tripod, and what we mean is really locked on a tripod, not loose on a gimbal head or something like that, then it's best to disable the lens or the in-camera stabilization. Mm-hmm. And so those work. And then recently, I mean, you'll have to look at your camera, but there's different stabilization modes. So you'll have to look and see how they behave. Some stabilize in all axes, try to remove all motion. And that's good if you're like on a boat or something, jumping up and, you know, bouncing around. Some mm-hmm. stabilize only in one axis, which is designed for, so it allows you to pan and it doesn't try to compensate for your panning the camera. Nikon just put in a mode called Sport VR a few years back that started showing up. That helps the image viewfinder not jump so much between shots. And that's a thing that can happen. If you have a fast moving subject and you're tracking it, and if you press the shutter release and the stabilization is on, sometimes what will happen is the stabilization works, but then because you've reframed it in the time that you've taken the picture, the viewfinder image will jump, and yep. it can be hard. So that sport mode is allowed, you know, it tries to do that. But there's so many different ones out there that you just kind of have to read up on them to look at it. But as a general rule, I don't see any problems in my photos when I'm shooting with stabilization on, using a monopod or even a tripod on a gimbal head or handheld. Or with my shoulder stock that I have, for example, which is a nice complement to a monopod. Just leave the stabilization on and shoot above a thousandth of a second or faster than. And mm-hmm. it seems to work just fine. But I will say one thing with telephotos. If you get one, especially the longer lengths, practicing is really necessary. And this is really important if you're doing wildlife stuff, but any kind of photography where it's like using a telescope. If you've ever had a telescope, they used to have that little spotting scope on the top so that you mm-hmm. could more or less align the telescope to what you're trying to find first, because mm-hmm. looking through the camera, looking through that long lens really has a narrow angle of view, and it can be really hard sometimes to find that bird on the branch if you're not used
Absolutely.
To it.
Absolutely.
So practicing is you get better with time. You get better with being able to spot the subject and frame it and focus on it, especially if it's a fleeting subject like a bird or an animal of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that's very cool about the longer focal lengths is the control over the background they offer.
Yes. You know,
when we were talking about ability to blur it out, but it's also the idea that very small changes in the angle that you're shooting at or exactly where you plant your feet can make the background look incredibly different. It's because you're essentially looking at it through a soda straw, right? Mm-hmm. And so you can find theoretically a portion of the background that's green or blue or orange or red. It depends on where you are. And just by those subtle adjustments, how you frame the subject and what's behind the subject can be completely different. You know, like one of the things I played with, you know, when I did that shoot in Maine a long, long time ago with my 200 to 400 was shooting flowers where the background was either very colorful and bright, and then I would find just a slightly different angle where I could make the background go completely black. And I had these bright orange flowers against a very dark background, and it just gave it a completely different look. So it's just something to be thinking about while you're out there shooting. Doesn't matter if it's flowers or a person or animal, you can do a lot with subtle movements in a long lens.
Yeah, and the closer you get to your subject, the more that background is going to blur out, even with a slower telephoto lens, even if it's not a fast 2.8, you know, or an f4 prime, you know, even with a 5.6 lens or even a 6.3, you can blur out those backgrounds quite easily by getting closer to your subject and using that longer focal length. So, I mean, it's definitely an experiment worth conducting at home, you know, just playing around and seeing how those backgrounds get rendered. And it's also a good just general thing, because as photographers, backgrounds a lot of times make the difference between, you know, an okay shot and a great shot. And so learning how to recognize and visualize those backgrounds through your viewfinder as you're composing is really a good thing to just do, no matter what kind of lens you're using, quite honestly. But we're just bringing it up in this context.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that you have to force yourself to do. I think the normal thing for people to do is to put their focus just on the subject, and they tend to not look at the background. It's just the way the human brain works, you know, when you're photographing. But if you can train yourself to start looking around the frame and thinking more actively about your choice of background, you'll get better shots.
Absolutely. So I'm running out of things on our list to talk about.
Just two quick things that I.
Yeah. So what else do you have? I'm looking at my list. I'm just trying to make sure.
One, and we'll make this really short. Teleconverters are a way to get a little bit more. 1.4s are almost always going to be a little bit sharper than a 2x. You'll lose less light with a 1.4 than you will a 2x, but both of those can work. And, you know, obviously the best results will be a really good lens and a really good teleconverter. That's just a fact. And the worst results, you pick a bad version of either one of those things, and you might not be too happy.
Well, the less expensive lenses, I will just say, something like a 70 to 300 zoom, and people say, I can put a teleconverter on it. Well, one, see if it even mounts, because I know the Nikon ones won't be compatible. That's you know, and you can get a third-party teleconverter, but you're going to be disappointed most of the time, because any flaws that you might not notice will be magnified with a teleconverter. So at the end of the day, they really do work best for, unfortunately, the expensive lenses. I mean, it's just true. It's just how they are, because they magnify the good and the bad. So just be aware that you know, there is a common tendency for people to say, well, I'll just go get this cheap lens, I'll put a teleconverter on it, and now I'm at 600. And it is a setup for being disappointed.
Yeah. The other thing is the format of the camera.
Oh yeah.
Are you shooting a full frame, an APS-C / DX camera, Micro Four Thirds, and you know what happens with the angle of view, you know, just due to the format. And so, in some ways, using a camera with a smaller sized sensor format can seemingly get you a lot of bang for the buck, you know, with lenses, and you don't have to have one that's quite as large. But there's another way of doing it, which especially with today's mirrorless cameras works pretty well, and that's to put the camera into a crop mode. And unlike with a DSLR where you could do that, but it was a little bit harder to compose because the viewfinder didn't change. Now with the mirrorless ones, you see the entire viewfinder filled up just like you weren't in a crop mode of any sort. And it works pretty well. It's not the same thing as using a longer lens.
Right.
You know, you're not going to see the same depth of field. You will see the same perspective. And so things like we were talking about where they get that compressed perspective on the landscape or whatever, that's absolutely true. But all you're doing is just cropping the image down. So you could, you know, with today's really high resolution sensors that are out there, things that are 45 megapixels plus, when you crop those down to a DX or APS-C mode, you're right in the range of very reasonable results. You're in the 20, sometimes 24 megapixel range, depending on the specific camera. And that's pretty darn good. That's more than enough to make a gorgeous print. So it is another option. It's not quite the same.
Right. And for people who say, well, why don't you just crop after the fact? Because you can do that too. I mean, honestly, sure. Changing your camera's crop mode to a more reduced angle of view is no different than in terms of what comes out as cropping your original full frame image. But the reason why you would maybe want to do that in camera would be, one, it helps you compose anyway. You know, you're going to compose it better.
Absolutely.
Because you know, if you know you're going to be cropping it after the fact anyway, there's no point. And then two, you do produce a smaller image. For most cameras will, you know, they will produce that image. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but at least with Nikons, you get a cropped image out. You don't get the full frame coming back. So you save space on your memory card. In some cases, it can help you increase your frame rate if you're doing burst shooting. There are reasons. You just have to check your camera to see what it does with like raw files, for example. But mm-hmm. at least with Nikons, it crops the file in camera. So you'll get a much smaller file. You can store more photos on a card if you do that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we've probably forgotten something, but if you've got questions for us or comments, or you want to share your experience with us, we would certainly appreciate your feedback over at our Facebook page, facebook.com/imagedoctors. We'll be looking for you there. And until next week, happy shooting.
Yep. Get out there and try some of this stuff.
All right. See ya.
All right. Bye-bye.